I'm Barb DeMarco Barrett, and you're listening to Writers on Writing. My guest today is Charlotte McConaghy, author of the novels Once There Were Wolves and Migrations. Charlotte, who is with us from Australia, and I talked about writing in the first person present tense, how wolves are vital to bringing the forest back to life, first lines, and so much more. I loved both of her novels so much. I hope you enjoy our talk as much as I did. Charlotte, Once There Were Wolves was such an intriguing book. I loved it from the start, and as I did Migrations, actually. And I wonder if you would talk about how Once There Were Wolves came about.
Sure, yes. So I was originally inspired by the story of, I don't know if you have heard of it, but there's an enormous organism in Utah called Pando the Trembling Giant. And it's a forest of quaking aspen trees. Except that it's not actually a forest, it's one tree that's all the shoots are connected to this enormous underground root system. And a lot of scientists believe that it's the oldest living organism and largest living organism in the world. It's been alive for nearly a million years, but it's dying now due to human impact. So I was reading about this extraordinary tree forest, and I learnt that kind of the perfect and most elegant solution to this issue, to saving this huge organism, would be to reintroduce wolves into that forest to keep the deer population moving and to allow this tree to grow again. But that would never happen because local fear, the farmers and the hunters wouldn't allow that to happen. So I kind of instantly had this story come to life in my mind, and I knew that I needed to tell the story of this, of a woman who was bringing back the wolves to a place to save a forest, and that's kind of where Inti came into life. And I went for a walk, and about 15 minutes later I had the entire book arrive in my mind, which is really strange. It's not usually how my ideas come to me. They're quite slow and painful usually, but this was just kind of sudden and fully formed. And I just kind of knew that there would be twins, there would be a romance with someone that she started to become suspicious of. I knew that there would be a body turn up and that the wolves would be blamed, and that she would go to kind of extreme lengths in order to save her wolves.
And I don't want to give away the ending, but did you have the ending too? Did it come along with the ending?
Yeah, pretty much. I needed to do some massaging, of course. There's always, when you've got a mystery or a crime element in there, it does take a lot of sort of plotting work. So obviously that stuff didn't kind of come fully formed. It was more of a ongoing kind of problem to be solved. But I had a general sense of what I wanted the ending to be, as in who done it, I knew.
It was such a twist. It was an incredible twist, which of course is wonderful. And I think the other thing about this novel is that, yes, there is a mystery in it, and it's also a literary novel, and there's a lot of things going on. There's abuse as a theme, right? Abuse of forests, animals, women. I mean, there's so many layers, and I wonder if you could talk a little bit about those layers and how you did it. I mean, did you keep it? Was it all in your head then? I mean, or do you have paper all over your walls and notes all over the place so that you can keep the different subplots in line? I mean, how do you work?
Well, I Most of it is in my head. I definitely do take notes. But the funny thing is I never relook at the notes. I just kind of write stuff down. And I think it's the process of writing it down that maybe cements it a little bit in my head. Because I often, yeah, like I said, will not go back and reread anything. Although once I get to a certain point, usually if I get a bit stuck, I like to step away, write everything, write all my plot points down on note cards and then stick them up on the wall so I can kind of look at them all and see the shape of the structure. And that tends to be how I kind of, I suppose, work out how to interweave the storylines. For me, I think the most important thing to always come back to and remember when you've got multiple, I guess, plots or stories or characters or just multiple things that you want to explore, it's crucial for me to always make sure that those stories all come down to the same theme. So when I was kind of, I guess, exploring what this book was about, I knew that I wanted to write about wolves and the cruelty that humans place on wolves, the slaughter of animals, the damage that we're doing to our environment. There was also this other thing that was really bothering me, and that was the mistreatment of women, male violence against women, as you mentioned. And I didn't quite know how those two things would work together in the same story until I sort of picked away at them and just broke them down to their core kind of thematic. And I realized they're both about what happens to human beings when we don't foster empathy within ourselves. Mm. So, you know, the story ultimately is about empathy and lack of empathy and what that creates in us. And the two things suddenly worked together in the same story and then were therefore much easier to kind of interweave and to make work on the whole.
Hmm. So Inti, your protagonist, has mirror touch synesthesia, and so she's an extreme empath. And yeah. And when did this come into the book? I mean, when you came up with her character, did this also come to you right away that she would have to have this sort of suffer from this ailment?
Yeah. So I heard about this incredible, strange and rare condition many years ago and have been fascinated with it ever since, and sort of knew I wanted to write a character with this condition, but I never quite knew who she would be or which book she would be in until this idea came. And I realized that, you know, what better way to explore empathy than with somebody who has such an extreme case of empathy that it becomes not just a gift of connection, but also a burden. You know, it's dangerous to her. She's very vulnerable because of it. And so I was able to sort of use that character trait to explore why we might close ourselves off to empathy and what that causes us to become, how much smaller it makes us. And how important it is to open back up to that if we have the courage, because that's, you know, that's how she reconnects with not only the animals and the environment, but the people around her who she's sort of closed herself off to.
Yeah. And as I was reading, I was thinking that she either hates or fears humans.
Mm.
And
yeah. At the beginning, yes.
At the beginning, yeah. I mean, she, you know, she definitely has a character arc, but it was interesting because she almost feels too much.
Mm. Yeah, I would agree with that completely. I think we see Inti, the start of her life, being very open to this empathy, this connection to other people, to seeing the best in other people, to forgiveness. But over the course of her life, whether it's this synesthesia or just the reality of being alive and human, she starts to, I guess, become all too aware of the cruelty that humans are capable of, the harm that they do, not just to each other, but also to the natural world. And I think she just reaches a point. I mean, there's a specific trauma that happens in her and her sister's life that kind of, I guess, pushes her over the edge. Mm-hmm. When we meet her, she has just absolutely had enough of people and has no more forgiveness for their cruelty and has closed herself off. She's angry, I think, is kind of the main thing that she allows herself to be at the start of this novel. And so, yeah, her journey is about, I guess, being able to open back up to seeing the good in people again.
Hmm. You get so close to her in the first person present tense. And I noticed you did that with your narrator in Migrations as well. What is it about that tense, that first person, the present tense that that you obviously love?
Yeah, I do love it. I think it's just, for me, it's the ultimate kind of intimacy. It just allowed me and the reader, I think, to get really close, really kind of deep inside these women's head. I'm curious about exploring other point of views and tenses because I'm currently working on something that I'm actually doing close third person, which is, you know, it's a bit of an experiment for me. I'm I'm trying to allow that same intimacy and connection while writing in a different way. And it's, you know, it's really interesting for me to explore that. But I do naturally gravitate towards that first person because I just think it's you really connect with it.
Could you see in the current project going from the close third back to first?
Well, in this project, I want to be able to explore more characters. Sure. That's one of the things that I found most challenging with both Migrations and Once There Were Wolves, just being contained to this one person. Mm-hmm. Because my background is in writing. When I was a lot younger, I wrote a lot of kind of epic fantasy sprawling novels. And you know, you naturally move around to a lot of characters. And so that was my sort of natural space. And it was challenging to move into just telling the story of one character. And I think that's why I probably, fell back on using multiple narratives, non-linear structure, so two timelines, because that for me just kind of opens it up. But with this new project, it's kind of a challenge going back to that third person, moving around now to multiple characters and being able to tell all of their stories, but maintaining that intimacy.
Hmm. Yeah, in this novel, Inti's father, I could see where he would have been a really interesting character too, because he has dealt with so much. Well, I mean, not an interesting character, but an interesting point of view character. Yes. Where, you know, he was a logger and he's reeling from the damage he did and the damage that continues to be done to trees. And I thought the novel was pretty perfect the way it is, but I could see the, you know, that there could be a frustration with, you know, being so into just one narrator the entire time without telling other stories.
Yeah, yes, it is. It can be frustrating, definitely. But I think there's also something quite powerful in just really allowing us to stay with this woman and I guess to tell those other people's stories through her lens. Mm-hmm. I think that's interesting in itself. You know, the way that Inti sees the world, is that going to colour the way that she sees these other characters? And can I allow the reader to know these other characters through her eyes and also kind of give hints of who they might be separately? That's the challenge, I think. It's the kind of tricky thing about that first-person narration. But I think it's very rewarding if you can get it right.
Yeah, I love it. I mean, that tends to be how I write. And I'm not in the present tense, and which is partly what was so interesting about this was you got so deep and it never, it never became grueling or, you know, sometimes you can get almost too close to a character as a reader And, you know, you always maintain such a nice, nice balance where you're telling the story of this time of the this Scottish region, of the wolves and the people who live there. But we're always seeing everything through Inti. And it was excellent. You did it. It was great.
Thank you very much.
I'm curious about the wolves, because as I read on, I of course began to understand what Inti is talking about in terms of the wolves bringing the forest back to life. At first, I really was confused, and just in general, because we don't think of things that way. We don't think of animals, of wild animals, as having responsibility or allowing them to have that responsibility. So that was so interesting. I wonder if you'd talk a bit about that, about, there's a line, wolves don't need forests, they grow them. Could you talk a bit about that?
Sure, yeah. So one of the things that I was just completely fascinated by and surprised by, when I sort of read this initial story and this idea of wolves rescuing something came into play, I of course looked into it more, and I went down a bit of a rabbit hole on research around wolves. And I just, it's so incredible the power that they have over their environments. They're a keystone species, which means that they have trickle down effects on everything else living in their ecosystem. Mm-hmm. So because they, all predators are crucial elements of an environment, because they come in, they hunt the herbivores and stop the herbivores from getting overpopulated. When herbivores get overpopulated, they eat all the plants and shoots, so nothing grows, and then you start to lose all the other animals. When you bring the predators back in, everything kind of moves back into balance. Mm-hmm. And we see things grow again. We see animals return. We see the health of water tables and rivers starting to change direction. It's really quite a profound impact. And it just speaks to how crucial biodiversity is in our environments, and how we have to start thinking about things in balance and in harmony. If you take away one element, everything else gets thrown out. You know, we can't start thinking that it's okay to kill off a predator and it have no impact on our earth. So, I mean, when you look at things like that, it's just kind of a beautiful harmony that exists in the natural world. And I sort of wanted to tell a story of that harmony, and also of our need to be a part of that again.
We've got to get government officials to read your book.
Yeah, well, that would be great. I mean, the sad thing is they probably know this stuff, and they just, I don't know. I feel like some of them just don't care.
Yeah, they don't care. How much research did you have to do?
Yeah, a lot. I spent a lot of time reading. Obviously, living in Australia, we don't have wolves here, and I didn't have access to real wolves. So I just immersed myself in the world of this really excellent precedent, which is the Yellowstone reintroduction project in the 90s. So they brought back wolves really successfully there. I mean, it was ecologically successful. It was socially very complex. Mm-hmm. But that was just an amazing kind of source of inspiration for me, because I guess the benefit of having a few decades under their belt in hindsight, you know, they can really kind of look at that project and look at the way that it's impacted the environment and kind of see the success of it. And there were a lot of the scientists that worked on those projects and with those wolves who wrote books about it, they're amazing. Like, they're so interesting to read. And so I just kind of sank into that world and read all these kind of accounts and started to become aware of I guess, the challenges of working with animals and the challenges of never quite understanding these animals, and but also allowing for the beauty of the mystery of them, and to embrace that kind of mystery, and the kind of gorgeous uniqueness of the wolves' personalities. I really wanted to do that justice in my book. I wanted them to feel like characters in their own right that we could fall in love with. So it was a really fascinating process of research. I loved it.
The wolves do become characters, and you feel for them as, you know, as they go through dealing with humans, right?
Yes.
I'd love to hear you read.
Sure, yes. I'll just read a couple of pages from the start of the book. I think it's not quite the opening, but it's quite close.
All right.
Not long ago, not in the grand scheme of things, this forest was not small and sparse, but strong and bursting with life. Lush with rowan trees, aspen, birch, juniper and oak, it stretched itself across a vast swath of land, colouring Scotland's now bare hills, providing food and shelter to all manner of untamed thing. And within these roots and trunks and canopies, there ran wolves. Today, wolves once again walk upon this ground, which has not seen their kind in hundreds of years. Does something in their bodies remember this land as it remembers them? It knows them well. It has been waiting for them to wake it from its long slumber. Now, in a different part of the world, the dark is heavy and their breathing is all around. The scent has changed, still warm, earthy, but muskier, which means there's fear in it, which means one of them is awake. Her golden eyes find just enough light to reflect. Easy, I bid her without words. She is wolf number 6, the mother, and she watches me from her metal crate. Her pelt is pale as a winter sky. The paws haven't known the feel of steel until now. I'd take that knowledge from her if I could. It's a cold knowing. Instinct tells me to try to soothe her with soft words or attend to touch, but it's my presence that scares her most, so I leave her be. I move lightly past the other crates to the back of the truck's container. The rolling door's hinges rasp as they let me free. My boots hit the ground with a crunch. An eerie world, this night place. A carpet of snow reaches up for the moon, glowing for her. Naked trees cast in silver, my breath making clouds. There's no more road for the truck, so we're on foot now. We lift number 6's container first, Niels and I taking a back corner each, while burly Evan carries the front on his own. Amelia, our vet and the only local among us, will remain here with the other two containers to keep watch. It's a little over half a mile to the pen and the snow is deep. The only sound 6 makes is a soft panting that signals her distress. A loon calls, distinct and lovely. I wonder if it stirs her, that lonely cry in the night. A recognition of the same ancient call she makes. But if it does, then she doesn't reply in any way I can interpret. It seems to take an age to reach the pen, but eventually I make out its chain link boundary. We place 6's container inside the gate and head back for the other two animals. I don't like leaving her unguarded, but very few know where in the forest these pens have been placed. Next, we carry male wolf number 9. He's a massive creature, so this second hike is harder than the first. The third wolf is a yearling female, number 13. She is 6's daughter and lighter than either of the adults. By the time we've carried 13 to the pen, it's nearly dawn and exhaustion has set into my bones. But there is excitement too and worry. Female number 6 and male number 9 have never met. They are not from the same pack, but we are placing them in a pen together in the hopes they will decide they like each other. We need breeding pairs for this to work. It's just as likely they'll kill each other. We open the 3 containers and move out of the pen. 6, singularly conscious, doesn't move. Not until we retreat as far as we can without losing sight of them. She doesn't like the scent of us. Soon we see her lithe form rise and pad out onto the snow. She is nearly as white as the ground she walks so lightly upon. She too goes. A few seconds pass as she lifts her muzzle to smell the air, maybe taking note of the leather radio collar we have placed around her neck. And then, instead of exploring the new world, she lopes quickly to her daughter's container and lies beside it. It stirs something in me, something warm and fragile I have come to dread. There is danger here for me. Let's call her Ash, Evan says. Dawn burnishes the world from grey to golden, and as the sun rises, the other two animals stir from their drugged sleep. All 3 wolves emerge from their containers into their single acre of glittering forest. for now, it's all the space they'll be given and it's not enough. I wish there didn't have to be fences at all. Turning back to the truck, I say, no names, she's number six. And that will do.
Thank you so much. As you were reading, I was wondering if you read your work aloud when you're writing or revising.
No, I don't, actually. I find that too embarrassing.
Why is that?
I don't know. I think I become too self-conscious. It's different, I think, after it's published and I'm just reading it, you know, to you now. But I think when I'm writing it, there's something too, just far too kind of, I don't know how to describe it. There's a self-consciousness there.
I ask because it's the writing is so musical. It's almost as if you are at some point during the writing process reading it aloud and adding a beat here or taking a beat away and, you know, just really perfecting the sound of the prose. So it's interesting that you don't read it.
Yeah. Well, I guess I do that sort of thing in my head. And and it's funny that you say that it's musical because I have to listen to music while I'm writing. So perhaps there's something of that in the prose. I think it does help with that kind of rhythm and the feel and the being able to kind of sink into it, I suppose.
Do you have to listen to specific kinds of music or specific songs? Do you put on the same stuff?
Yeah, but definitely things that are sort of I suppose if I was writing a kind of intense dark scene, I wouldn't put on something happy, we'll just say. So, you know, the kind of the feel of it has to suit the mood. It tends to be melancholy, it tends to be dramatic. I love movie scores because they're so kind of sweeping and beautiful, and I think they're designed to go with as part of a method of storytelling, so they sort of work alongside something else, something visual or something audible.
What's one that you listened to while you were writing this?
Putting me on the spot.
That's okay. That's all right.
Yeah, it's been a while. I wrote this book years ago, but I'd have to go back through. Lots of kind of period pieces are really good for soundtracks. So I also love Max Richter. I love Craig Armstrong. The soundtrack to Wind River is actually really beautiful. It's by Nick Cave. It's got some gorgeous songs in there. So I had a few of those on repeat, and it actually was really perfect because that movie is kind of, there's wolves all throughout it. So it worked beautifully.
Oh, I've never seen it.
Oh, it's so good. It's really good.
I must. Okay. I will. So I'm also curious if, because I think you have a screenwriting background. Is that accurate?
Yeah.
Does the way you work with structure come from that, from what you learned in screenwriting?
Yes, definitely. So I was writing novels first, and then I went and I reached a point where I just felt like I needed some story craft. I needed to learn more about how to tell stories. So I went and did two screenwriting degrees, and just really, screenwriting is excellent for structure. You have to be really on point with your structure, and you learn about why that is and how structure is not a prison as some people kind of assume that it is. It's actually, it liberates you because it allows you to tell the best version of your story. It allows you to transform your characters in the most cathartic way. In screenwriting, you learn things like how to use genre tools. But the main kind of thing I found was that it was just really good for creating brevity in my writing and simplicity and a visual kind of language that allows you to inhabit a space. So it was incredibly important to my prose writing.
You know, I'm trying to think if metaphor and simile are big in this novel. Somehow
I tend not to use a lot of similes, but I'm pretty big on metaphor, I guess.
Mm-hmm. So why not simile and why metaphor?
Similes are funny things. I actually find I'm not good at them. I think you've got to be good at similes or you shouldn't use them, because there's a real trap with similes where you start to use cliches. Mm-hmm. If you don't have a really great imagination for them, your whole kind of use of them becomes really cliched. So, and I'm not... I don't know. I just don't feel like I'm very good at them. So I would prefer not to kind of, you know, if you use a bad simile, it can really ruin a scene. It can kind of, you know, it makes people associate weird images. And I don't know. I think, yeah, it's a real art form, you doing a good simile. And if you're good at it, then amazing. Mm. Metaphor is more of an instinctive thing for me. I don't go into writing and with this kind of, everything's going to be metaphorical and symbolic. But I think I naturally am inclined to do that without even realizing it. I often sort of, it takes me to the end of a book to realize, oh, yeah, that was kind of a symbol for that and that was kind of a metaphor for that. So, it's just a weird natural thing, I think, that I do, because I'm trying to have, I guess, reflections of things always appearing and to always be exploring the same theme. Hmm.
Yeah, we were just talking about that last night. I was talking about that with my students about, you know, if you can't come up with just the most unique, singular simile, just don't do it.
Totally. Yeah. As soon as you use a simile that somebody else has used, it's lazy.
Yeah. I'm curious what you think about categorization, because I don't know that I came to either of these novels with any idea of what category they might fall into, but I know the New York Times called Once There Were Wolves a romantic mystery. And I wondered what you thought about that.
Yeah, I love that. I think that's a beautiful way of describing it. I mean, the funny thing about these books is they are hard to categorize, because they do sort of, they embrace a lot of elements of several genres. You know, I think, I mean, they're very much, there's elements of nature writing. A lot of people refer to them as cli-fi, which is an interesting new genre that's emerging. And I have mixed feelings about that, to be honest, because I kind of feel like, in one sense, I love this idea of cli-fi as its own thing, but I also sort of feel like if you're writing a contemporary piece in this day and age, how could you not write about the climate? I mean, it's like I think this idea of the world we live in now needs to inhabit a lot of different genres. You know, you can write about climate in a crime novel. You can write about climate in a romance, in a literary fiction book. You know, it's just, to me, it's so real that it defies genre convention. I think in a lot of genres, we sort of, I guess the tropes of genre are that they become, we have to suspend our disbelief in various ways for different genres. And this whole climate thing is not something that we have to suspend our disbelief. It's almost like it's sort of ultra hard realism. even with something like Migrations, which is set slightly in the future, so there's a speculative element to it. It's so familiar and it's so current and present that the book does not feel like a science fiction novel to me. Anyway, rambling on about all of that, but I guess the point is that, they do fit a number of different categories, and I kind of love that, because I love the idea of, I like a lot of different categories, and I don't think we need to just fit each piece of work into one of them.
Yeah, I agree. I love that too. And, I was also wondering, there's so much to talk about and so little time, but I wanted to also talk about the first lines and the beginnings of each novel, because the first line of Once There Were Wolves is, let me get to it. It's just so, just takes you right in. When we were eight, Dad cut me open from throat to stomach. And in Migrations, it is, the animals are dying. Soon we will be alone here. And those first lines are just so wonderful and intriguing. There's so much emphasis on first pages and first lines by agents and editors and just, you know, everybody talking about books and writing. Did those lines come to you? Did you work at getting them perfect? Can you talk about beginnings?
So Migrations, I wrote a draft of the book before I wrote that line. What I find is really helpful with an opening line is actually to have written the whole book. Well, at least for that project it was. I found that I needed to know the whole piece before I could understand how to present it, I suppose. And then that line kind of, it felt like it contained a lot. Whereas the first line for Once There Were Wolves actually came first. So that was the opposite. I wrote that one and then I wrote the rest of the novel. And I think I can remember working on the Migrations opening line. I can't remember working on Once There Were Wolves. I think it just came out and I didn't give it a second thought. It just felt right and natural and I just kept writing from that point. I mean, but you always want to be bold. You want the first line to do a lot of work, carry a lot of weight, alert the reader to what they're going to be reading, the feel, the sort of, yeah, just, I guess, make them feel something in that first line. That's the challenge I found.
That first line of Once There were Wolves, that first line, of course, what's happening here is that we're learning that Inti is a mirror touch, has mirror touch synesthesia. Yes. But what's wonderful about it is that you don't then explain what is going on. We have to keep reading because that line, you're going, what? How can she be telling this story if that happened? And then as it goes on, you unspool the story. And I think that, you know, writers are very impatient to tell it all too soon. And you hold a lot of things back here, which I think is intriguing and made me want to read on, because I didn't know that they were twins right away. I mean, it took a while for me to get that. And I just love that. You do that about a few different things. And is that purposeful? I mean, are you going, no, I'm going to hold back on this. I'm going to, you know, this is how this is going.
Definitely. I mean, there's nothing that kind of annoys me more than when you start a novel and you get a big dump of exposition. I just find it so off-putting. So for me, I find it much, much more interesting to sink into a character's world and to get hints of things that will become revealed later, because I think there's something really gratifying about having something revealed that you've been wondering about. It feels good to kind of work something out and go, oh, that's what that meant. I think there's also a lot of tension you can build into a story in just giving hints of something. And you know, it's like, it's just a kind of classic trick, isn't it? You give a teaser of something and then you make people read on to find out the truth. And I think particularly with that opening and with the synesthesia, there was a moment. So I I gave this novel to my mum and my grandma before I sent it to my editor. I always give it to my mum and my grandma. They're my kind of first port of call. And my grandma's first reaction was, oh God, is this a weird sci-fi thing? And so I had this moment of going, oh God, maybe this is the wrong way to start this book. Is it signaling something strange to people? But I had to kind of reel myself back in from that edge and be brave about it and go, no, maybe it will be strange, you know, a strange way to open this, and maybe it will make people think of magic. But that's kind of the amazing strangeness of the reality of this condition. It almost does seem magical sometimes. And if I just have trust in the reader to read on a little bit more, they will understand that this is actually a neurological condition and they're not reading a sci-fi novel. So there's trust and faith, you know, that you've got to have in your readers to carry on with you when you're holding things back.
Well, as we get to the end of our talk, I'm curious if there's been anything lately that you've read that you've loved, or are there books that you know, reread and go back to and.
I really love anything by Lily King. I think she's amazing.
Euphoria.
Yeah, gorgeous book. It's like, it's such a kind of interesting exploration of, you know, scientific things as well as human relationships. And I suppose that's where I quite like exploring similar themes. I am currently reading The Bass Rock by Evie Wild, which is beautiful. She's an Australian writer, and I'm really enjoying the kind of, yeah, the beautiful writing in that. I loved Burial Rites by Hannah Kent. I read Night Bitch by Rachel Yoder recently, which was fun because I just had a baby. So, you know, that's a book about motherhood turning you into kind of wild animals. I definitely sort of felt apt for the sleepless phase that I'm in my life right now.
And I guess in closing, I wonder if there is any advice that you've been given along the way that has stayed with you. Any sort of writing advice that you remember?
Yeah, I remember when I was a teenager actually being told by a writer not to be too precious. So, and that's kind of stayed with me a little bit, and it's made, I mean, just in terms of the editing process, that's made life a lot easier for me. I think we can get really caught up in sort of the perfection of our words, and sometimes it's really important to listen to other people's voices. That being said, there's a fine line, and you've got to find the balance between not being too precious and fighting for what's important to you. So I've had instances where, you know, various editors have kind of said, I think this bit needs to go. And I've felt, you know, to my core, that that's the bit of the book that, you know, that means the most. And so when you feel that way, it's okay to put your foot down, to hold the line. And sometimes the editor will come around and agree with you. Sometimes they won't. But, you know, that's your voice that you need to kind of maintain. So, yeah, it's a balancing act between the two things. I would say also for new writers, the whole thing about not being too precious applies also to whole manuscripts. If you're going out to agents and publishers and you're having no luck, don't be afraid to put that work away. Put it in a drawer, start something new. You know, always be writing, always be exploring, challenging yourself. If you're having no luck with something, maybe in future you can come back to it and make it better. But I would say don't be frightened of kind of starting something new.
Do you have unfinished or unsold books in your drawer?
Yeah. Heaps.
Really?
Yeah, not heaps, but I've got several manuscripts that I never finished, and I've got one book actually that got me my agent in America, but it didn't. Well, we got one offer for it, but most of the editors came back and said, look, it's, you know, what else do you have? Because we're not super keen on this exact novel, but we like your writing. So that spurred me on to go away. And actually, that's how I wrote Migrations. Huh. So it was kind of acknowledging, yeah, you know, this isn't the book to start my novel writing career on. Let's put it aside. Let's not kind of be devastated about it. Let's just explore something new.
Will you bring it out again?
No, I'm over that book. It's been put to bed. I've definitely evolved from that point. But the other thing I do want to say for new writers is this gets said to death, and I know that it's a cliche, but it's so, so important. Write about what you're passionate about. I would have been so lost in these books so many times if I wasn't always coming back to what really matters to me. What is the heart of this? Why do I care about it? Why do I love it? You know, that carries you through feeling lost and feeling stuck and feeling like you don't know what you're writing about.
Great stuff. Thank you so much for spending the time. As I said, I love both of these books and can't wait for your next. And thank you so much.
Thank you very much for having me. It was lovely to chat.
That was Charlotte McConaghy, author of Once There Were Wolves. This episode was produced by me, Barbara DeMarco Barrett, on February 17th, 2022. Music and sound editing was by Travis Barrett. If you want to know more about the show or you'd like to reach out to me or my co-host, Marie Stone, visit penonfire.com. Thanks for listening.